You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up at 85 years old, the scorekeeper for the Milwaukee Bucks might also be their historian. We'll learn more about his loyalty to the Bucks from a filmmaker who has captured his story in a new documentary.
First, Milwaukee's Common Council voted yesterday to ban conversion therapy, a controversial practice that attempts to change a child's sexual orientation.
It was a charged atmosphere in the council chambers, with supporters of the ban holding up rainbow flags and opponents yelling evil. Here's one man who was against the ban.
The city's telling me, as a father or a grandfather, that I cannot send my children and pay a therapist. The city is telling me I am not allowed to do that. That is an extension of government. That's an extension of government and is wrong.
The practice has been banned in 9 states and a number of cities across the country. One woman who attended yesterday described why she wanted Milwaukee to follow suit.
I think God wants us to be close to God and not be separated, not be told that God doesn't love us as we are, as God made us.
That audio was from WBRC-TV in Milwaukee. Mary Spicuzzo reports on politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she covered the meeting yesterday, and she's here with us now to talk more about it. Mary, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So you wrote that the council chambers were packed yesterday, and we heard a little bit there of what the atmosphere was like. But Mary, tell us about the scene there from your perspective.
Yeah, it was extremely tense and emotionally charged in the chamber. It was probably the most full I've ever seen it. And there were definitely people on both sides. A lot of people were saying, you know, sin is sin. One man was saying the ban was evil. Then there were supporters of the ban who were holding rainbow flags and signs in support, essentially saying that to accept people as they are and not to change them. So there was definitely quite a few interruptions for the meeting of people either, you know, saying that this was sinful, or some were reading verses of the Bible. There were quite a few. It was pretty dramatic in there.
And we touched on it a bit in the intro there, but could you explain exactly what conversion therapy is?
Sure. So it's essentially an attempt, a practice, or a therapy that aims to change someone's sexual orientation or gender identity. This specific ban applies to children, so minors, people under 18, and it applies not to going to like a church or a priest and getting free guidance, but for clinics that charge a fee, saying that they can essentially change a child's sexual orientation or gender identity.
And I'm curious about how this proposal came about and the timing of it all. Who proposed this ban, and why now?
So this was from Alderman Cavalier Johnson, who's one of our newer Common Council members. He said that he thinks it's, that they pledge allegiance to the flag, and they say they're going to protect everyone, and that this is a attempt to protect children and to protect everybody, and that it's a matter of fairness. I do think that there's been a move around the country and attempts to ban it, some successful, some not. Wisconsin has not banned the practice throughout the state, obviously, but I think Milwaukee is hoping that other cities and possibly the entire state will follow suit.
And just to be clear, this is a ban just for minors, correct?
Just for minors, and just for conversion therapy where there's a charge, not free counseling or guidance from like a pastor, priest, faith leader. So essentially it's where families or parents will take a child, or someone will take a child to a clinic where there's a fee to undergo conversion therapy.
And then what would the punishments be for someone who would run afoul of this policy?
There could be a fine of between $500 to $1,000 per violation, and it could be enforced by the police department. It was unclear during the meeting how many clinics this would affect. I don't think anybody had any hard and fast statistics about how many clinics actually offer conversion therapy in the city, but clearly it was something that the council pretty overwhelmingly supported. It was a 12-2 vote with one abstention, and so while it was emotional and people had a lot of feelings about it and strong feelings about it, it did pass quite overwhelmingly.
We're talking right now with Mary Spicuzza of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we're looking at a new ban on conversion therapy in the city of Milwaukee. And Mary, you just talked about the vote, the 12-2. Overwhelmingly, the council voted to support this ban, but we had the two aldermen voting against it, Alderman Robert Donovan and Mark Borkowski. What was the rationale for voting against this?
So both of them raised concerns about the notification before the committee meeting where this was initially passed before going to the full council. Opponents had said that they didn't have enough time in advance, enough advance notice to kind of gather forces and show up in opposition. The sponsor, Cavalier Johnson, said that there was actually more notice given than a lot of the kind of the typical 24-hour, that it was actually more like 72 hours. So he disputed that and disputed the idea that it wasn't properly noticed. You know, obviously a lot of people aren't reading committee agendas, so they didn't read about it, didn't see it until after it had passed. But clearly they've been making their voices heard. It sounds like a lot of aldermen and city officials have been getting emails from both sides, but I think that the opponents were out in force yesterday and were clearly not happy with the vote.
And it sounds like all that's left on this is for Mayor Tom Barrett to sign off on it. Has he signaled that this is something that he would support?
Yes, his spokeswoman said yesterday that he will sign it. It doesn't sound like he'll be having a public ceremony, which he doesn't do too many of those public signing ceremonies, but he does intend to sign it. And I think in the near future it'll officially become an ordinance.
And you said that, you know, certainly people who were opposed to this ban were sort of upset after the vote happened. Is there any discussion or is there any possibility of a legal challenge to this policy maybe in the coming weeks?
You know, they were saying there were critics afterwards. There was quite an uproar after the vote, and they clearly were not happy. They made that known, went into the hallway. They did say that they felt like it violated their rights as parents, rights as faith leaders. It does sound like the city attorney's office vetted this ordinance and didn't find any kind of constitutional concerns. That doesn't mean that they're, you know, somebody obviously may feel differently and file a lawsuit over it. It would probably have to be somebody affected by it, so I'm guessing maybe a conversion therapy clinic or someone who feels their work, or I guess maybe a parent says, you know, feels that they're being affected directly by it. But I guess we'll have to wait and see if there are any cases filed.
And I'm wondering, now that Milwaukee is going forward with this policy, does this have the potential to be replicated elsewhere or possibly even on a statewide basis?
Yeah, I definitely think so. There has been an attempt, which was unsuccessful, to ban it statewide, but that could certainly come back. Obviously, other communities could follow suit, and you know, even communities surrounding Milwaukee or cities around the state. So I wouldn't be surprised if this ends up on other agendas around the state and possibly at the state level again soon.
Well, Mary, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Mary Spicuzza reports on politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she was with us to talk about the Milwaukee Common Council's decision yesterday to ban a controversial therapy meant to change a child's sexual orientation. Usually the stars of the NBA are the players and the coaches, but one filmmaker has decided to turn the spotlight on someone different in the sport, the scorekeeper.
Bob Wanick, currently 85 years old, has been the scorekeeper for the Milwaukee Bucks for 50 years, and he is still going strong. To put that into context, he has scored 97 of the NBA's top 100 scorers of all time, and arguably knows more about the team than anyone on the planet.
Brendan T. Jones is a filmmaker from the Milwaukee area. His short documentary, Bob the Buck, will be featured at the Wisconsin Film Festival this year, and he's here to tell us more about this Bucks legend. Brendan, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you for having me.
All right, so before we get started, let's give a quick listen to the trailer for the film.
Are you busier when we play LeBron?
He's different. At least they finally stopped him. He used to come up and clap his hands with that powder, and now they won't let him do that anymore. Because it was getting into our drink and the book. And
Bob never missed a thing. He had all the names, he knew all the people. He knew where everything was and almost every speck of dust was in the building. Bob ran that joint.
Hi there, I'm Bob, scorekeeper for Milwaukee Bucks and head of the stats crew.
There's nothing around Milwaukee that is as old a relic as Bob Wanick.
So, Brendan, I got to be honest with you. Before this week, I did not know who Bob Wannick was. Now I want to know everything that I possibly can about this guy. What initially drew you to his story and wanting to tell this?
Well, I work in pro sports part-time, and I've seen Bob over the years at the games, and I remember seeing him when I was younger, too, and I used to be a fan. And he's just this little old man that walks around the arena, and I never really knew what he did. And one game, I was filling in for someone doing audio, and I was running some audio lines. And I finally went up to him. I'm like, hey, my name's Brendan Jones. Who are you? And he explained who he was and what he did. And I'm like, how long have you been here? He said, since 1968.
Wow.
It kind of blew me away, and I asked him if anyone had ever done a story on him, and he said only the papers, never any video. And I, as someone that likes to tell stories and always looking for a fun story to share, I was like, well, I've never done a short doc, and this seems like a perfect person to do it on.
So I know the Bucks are kind of in the middle of celebrating their 50th year, sort of corresponds with how long Bob has been working there. Was he the original scorekeeper for this team?
Yeah, he's been there since day one, essentially. Eddie Doucette, who's in the film, was in charge of PR. Jim Fitzgerald, the original owner and, you know, president of operations, brought in Eddie Doucette. Eddie met with Bob because Bob has been scoring Marquette games and Pulaski High School games in Milwaukee since, like, you know, out of high school. So Bob still does that on a volunteer basis for Pulaski. And so Bob was kind of like the authority on scorekeeping. And Eddie was like, I don't want to worry about this. You know, you seem to know everything. We'll bring you on. And so Bob has never left that position through multiple owners, different PR heads, administration. You know, he's been the constant over those 50 years. The next closest person would be John Steinmiller, who still works with the Bucks. And then John McLaughlin, who was the first draft pick in 1968 as part of the expansion draft. And John McLaughlin is keyed the original Buck because he was the first draft pick and the first player to score points for the Bucks, and he's now a commentator.
When you approached Bob about doing this documentary, how willing was he to open up and share some of these stories about what he did and his time with the team with you?
Yeah, Bob is, you know, Bob will start talking and telling a story as soon as the cameras are cut, and we're just, you try to like capture it on camera, but he's quite the open book, and he'll go on and on. It was just a hard kind of like when the camera's rolling, he kind of froze up at first, but over time, over multiple interviews, he kind of warmed up, and he kind of understood when I would show him some edits what we were doing, and he is just... he's got so much knowledge of the game. Like you had mentioned, he has seen 97 of the top 100 all-time scores. The three he hadn't seen were before the Bucks were formed in 1968, and that was Bob Pettit, Bob Cousy, and Dolph Shays, legends of the game from, you know, the 50s and early 60s.
And I think it's fair to say that he commands a lot of respect within the organization, so much so that some within the team organization have taken to calling him the commissioner. Can you talk more about how he earned that name? Was it just that he had this just innate, incredible knowledge of the team that, you know, perhaps no one else on the organization had?
Yeah, I mean, Bob's one of those guys that he loves math and stats, and he loves it because there's always a finite answer, and basketball is one of those games where, you know, the numbers need to add up, and everyone has, like, assists, turnovers, rebounds, field goals made. But when he was brought on, you know, the Bucks were only, like, a handful of people running the front office, and Bob was in charge of overseeing the stats and building that, you know, from pretty much scratch. This is before computers kind of dictated a lot of the game. Everything was manual, and Wayne Embry, the first African-American general manager, who now is with the Toronto Raptors, he coined Bob the commissioner, and Eddie Doucette called him the commissioner. John McLaughlin called him the commissioner, and they still do. They call him the commish because they said that he ran the place. You know, if they had a question regarding basketball, they would ask Bob. And to this day, you know, Bob walks around the halls. He meets with the coaches. He meets with the PR team. You know, he's kind of like the connection of the coach to the stats because he gets the lineups. He gives the team the stats, and after every game, he has to report to New York and give the official, you know, final tally.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to ask more about that because I've seen my fair share of basketball in the day, and I think I've never given any thought whatsoever to the position of the scorekeeper. How important is this position to the overall game, and kind of what is that person responsible for doing?
Well, yeah, over the years, it's definitely changed with, you know, advances in technology and computers. And now it's not just Bob. I mean, he does have a team that surrounds him that makes, like, he will give credit to, but he assembles that team. He sits at courtside and he documents by hand, you know, players, fouls, points, turnovers, rebounds. So pretty much, you know, he's marking down the game as it exists. So if a referee has a question as to, you know, when someone had a turnover or a foul, he can go back and he logs that. Now, there is also computerization, you know, software that they are using, but they will, if there is a mistake that Bob sees, they most likely will side with Bob, the non-computer, because they trust his judgment. And the NBA officials over the years have recognized Bob as being the best in the game.
So it seems like one could make some comparisons here to another Milwaukee sports veteran, Bob Uecker. After all, we're talking about two guys who have been with their respective teams for decades. Bob Uecker, as you know, loved by fans everywhere. But the man that you're profiling here in your documentary, maybe not as well known. But do you see some parallels kind of between the two?
Yeah. That's actually a really interesting parallel. I look at it as someone, Bob Uecker, like I'm in my mid-30s now, but, you know, riding in the with my dad in the car through the countryside with the windows open in the summer, listening to Bob Uecker's voice. It's kind of something you grew up with. Bob Uecker is kind of like, you know, the voice of the Brewers, whereas Bob Wanek has been in his capacity of scorekeeper for 50 years. But you don't know him. You know, he's kind of like the man behind the scenes, where Bob Uecker is kind of like, you know, known and almost like a celebrity figure. But both of them have contributed, obviously, a lot to sports. And, you know, sports are sports. It's entertainment. But when you start meeting the people behind the scenes in sports, you realize that it impacts lives differently, you know, not just the game, but careers. And there's many interesting positions that a lot of people don't know exist until you kind of see it firsthand.
So I would imagine after a career with a team for 50 years, you might think about slowing down a little bit. Do you get any sense from Bob that he's thinking about throwing in the towel anytime soon?
Yeah, that's funny. I just talked to him last game against the Clippers last Wednesday, and I was just talking to him about, hey, you know, how long do you want to do this? And he said his goal is 90 years old, which would be 55 seasons. And there was a gentleman in Philadelphia named Harvey Pollack who worked until he was 93. He passed away in 2015. He was with the NBA since 1946, their first season.
Oh, wow.
And he was with the Philadelphia Warriors. The Philadelphia Warriors moved to California and became the Golden State Warriors. And then there wasn't a team for a bit in Philly, but he worked with the NBA. And then he started when the 76ers came into Philadelphia. So he hadn't had the same position over, you know, 50-plus years, but he had been in the NBA. So one of Bob's goals is to, you know, make it into his 90s, just as that Harvey did. But Bob would still be the only scorekeeper, you know, that had the same position over 50 years. So it's very interesting that Bob doesn't want to slow down, because his life is pretty simple. You know, we go through his house. One of the interesting stories was, I want to talk about the basketball side. I didn't know he was, you know, kind of like a hoarder of statistical information and memorabilia until we started doing the documentary, and he showed us the bedroom with all the boxes and all of the, you know, merchandise over the years, the giveaways, the yearbooks and things like that. It's pretty fascinating. He has like a little museum in boxes in his house.
And Brendan, we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. I've got a million more questions I want to ask you, but thank you so much for joining us today.
Bye forever. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Brendan T. Jones is a filmmaker in Milwaukee. His short documentary, Bob the Buck, about longtime Milwaukee Bucks scorekeeper Bob Wanek, will be featured at the Wisconsin Film Festival on Friday, April 6th.
When you think of a playground, you might think of slides, monkey bars, teeter-totters, swings, all on a soft surface in case of falls. But if you're in Britain, you may think of fires, knives, saws, tools, and mud pits. Under adult supervision, that is. The New York Times recently reported on a movement there to inject more risk into playgrounds in the name of building resilience and grit. In fact, a sign at one London playground points out that risks have been intentionally provided.
A 2012 study in the journal Pediatrics found that U.S. parents often ask daycare staff to restrict their kids' physical activity for fear of injury. And some children say that they're bored with current playground options.
Barbara King is an anthropology professor emerita at the College of William and Mary. She recently wrote a piece titled, Is It Time to Bring Back Risk into Our Children's Playgrounds? On NPR's 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog. Barbara, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Judith. Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So you wrote that incorporating a little risk into children's play would be good for kids. How so?
Yes, the idea is controlled or limited risk, of course. And we think, people who are considering this issue, that it's helpful for kids, young kids, we're talking about elementary school children, not to necessarily be coddled during playtime, but to encounter under, you know, adult supervision, some things that, might give them pause, give them some challenge, give them a chance to build up some skills that they otherwise wouldn't if they're in a highly controlled environment. So the idea is just that it's a way to learn and to explore and to get ready for what's coming in the future.
And how much are today's playgrounds really designed not to allow for risk or to eliminate risk?
When I was researching for this piece that I wrote for NPR, it seemed that there was a kind of cultural divide, if you will, so that there are many playgrounds, not only in Britain, as you mentioned in your introduction, but throughout Europe, that have really bought into this idea of, for example, giving fairly high climbing structures, doing activities with the kids, controlled activities with knives, having campfires. You just don't see that on most American playgrounds or in most American schools at recess time. I was driving by the elementary school near my house here in Virginia earlier today and just looking at, you know, plastic slide, plastic swings, all very low to the ground, pretty sterile. So there are certainly exceptions to this with some communities in the United States, but it seems as if this really hasn't caught on here quite so much as it has in Europe and in Britain.
So knives and fire aside, how long have we been moving away from having some risk in U.S. playgrounds? Because I have to say I'm in my early 50s, and we were playing on concrete. And we had, you know, I remember getting my finger pinched in the metal swings, and yeah, it hurt, but, you know, I learned not to stick my finger there the next time. At what point did we really start moving towards this, you know, eliminate risk at any cost mentality?
Yeah, I can remember incidents in my own childhood that certainly resonate with what you've just said. But by the time my daughter was born in the early 1990s, that seems to have changed. I would say probably 80s, 90s. And when I had this piece that I wrote posted on social media, it's very interesting that a lot of parents were on board, but a lot of people said that we need to frame this issue in terms of changing medical care and medical costs. In other words, that just as we've had this push towards, you know, fewer risks for our kids, we've also had skyrocketing medical costs, and that a lot of people see that the two fit together. In other words, they're very reluctant to have their kids exposed to potential injury when it costs an arm and a leg to take them to urgent care or the emergency room. So I thought that that was interesting, and it gave me a different perspective on the question.
Well, and is there also the flip side of that, of the liability issue? Because the U.S. is a much more litigious society when it comes to things like injury and illness and assigning fault or blame. So is that also maybe contributing to this, is that whoever owns that playground doesn't want to be in a liability situation?
Yeah, I imagine that's true. So when I looked at what's happening in playgrounds overseas, it seemed as if they're very much trying to get community buy-in, for example, you know, putting up signs, consulting with parents, making sure that parents understand the idea is not simply to let kids loose, but to have teachers and parent volunteers and all of this around. So I think I would expect that the response to this might, you know, vary regionally in the United States, but it's also true that a lot of these playgrounds are government subsidized, for example, in Norway and Sweden and Germany and that kind of thing. So I think it takes time, and that we would need to really have a community movement in advance of just sort of springing this on people.
We're talking with Barbara King about her recent article titled, Is It Time to Bring Risk Back into Our Kids' Playgrounds? And Barbara, we've mentioned some of the elements, but can you describe some of these playgrounds in the UK or the rest of Europe or other places that are introducing this managed risk? What would we see if we went to one?
Yeah, well, two different things, I think, are worth mentioning here. When Ellen Barry wrote this article originally that caught my interest for the New York Times, she was describing that there are, for example, a 20-foot climbing platform at playgrounds in Britain that really get the kids up and moving and away from the ground, and they can swing quite a bit and be high up. Also, it even includes such things as the vegetation included on the playground. Instead of making sure that everything is sort of blunt and not sharp and rounded plastic edges of human-made equipment, they include some spiky bushes and things that the kids have to really watch out for. And you mentioned already the campfires was a pretty big thing. But in addition to the playground, something that I found interesting that seems to me related is the concept of the forest kindergarten that is big in Germany and Sweden and Norway, where kids don't just go for recess and encounter challenges and risk, but can be taken for entire days and weeks out into a park, or in some cases for the day, driven out into wilderness with their teachers, spending the whole day outside. And as it is in Wisconsin, of course, in some months it's quite cold in some of these countries, and the kids just stay out all day. They take nature walks. They, again, do activities with tools, build fires, look for animals. And this is the kind of thing that is considered part of education. So there are two levels. One is a playground where you go out for a little while and come back, and the other is even a bigger buy-in of having environmental learning in a very structured way in kindergartens.
When I was reading about having things like knives and saws and other tools, and like you were saying, really experiential learning, it reminds me of the concepts behind Montessori.
Yes, I know. It's true. I will never forget when my daughter first went to Montessori preschool here in our small community in Virginia, and it was a half day. We picked her up at the end of the half day, and she ran towards us and said, "We cut with scissors. We did things with tools." She didn't use the word tools, but she used another word, so I knew what she meant. And it was very exciting. So there is some of this, of course, replicated in certain types of American educational classrooms. And there are certainly some playgrounds here in the States where there's more risk involved. It is a variable thing. So I'm kind of talking in terms of generalizations. You know, as an anthropologist, I was interested not only in the cross-cultural perspective, how things differ in different countries, but also thinking in an evolutionary perspective. And what I did when I wrote this piece is I talked to a behavioral biologist at Cal State University Fullerton. Her name is Nia Nguyen, who studies monkeys in the wild. And she really made the interesting point that we, of course, are primates, and that we really have a long evolutionary history of going out there and as youngsters experiencing risk, that we didn't always have this environment of having parents watching out for everything. And so as an anthropologist, again, I find that both perspectives, the cross-cultural and the evolutionary, kind of pushing us in the same direction here.
Barbara King is an anthropology professor emerita at the College of William and Mary and a contributor to the NPR blog 13.7, Cosmos and Culture. Her recent entry was titled, "Is It Time to Bring Risk Back into Our Kids' Playgrounds?"
And you can let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. Do playgrounds need to be less safe and more risky? Are we coddling, protecting, and worrying too much about our kids' safety? What do you think of these British playgrounds with fires, knives, and tools? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We're continuing our conversation on whether the U.S. should take a page from Britain's playbook and stop making children's playgrounds so safe. We're talking with Barbara King, an anthropology professor emerita at the College of William and Mary. Her recent piece for NPR was titled, "Is It Time to Bring Risk Back into Our Kids' Playgrounds?"
And Barbara, let's go right to the phones. And Lisa in Janesville is up first. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I was just calling because, we lived in England. I worked at a preschool. And the playground was, there was a grassy area for them to get out and run and play on, but it was hard cement. There were pallets they could climb on. It was assumed the children would learn to assess the risk factor. They would learn to balance themselves. They did go to forest school where we made fires. They climbed trees. They did try to emulate the forest school in Germany where children would hike a mile every day to get to their school, and that was their school during the day, using saws and whatnot. Inside the school, the children also put their own bread in the toaster, and they worked the toaster, and these were 3- and 4-year-olds.
Wow.
And I was impressed at their abilities.
And Lisa, when you started working there, was it a surprise to you what the kids were exposed to?
Yeah, it caught me off guard, you know, and I had to relate to, okay, there aren't the lawsuits either in the UK that there are here. So they weren't worried about the parents suing them. Of course, there was, you know, the health system, so that was taken into account. But it caught me off guard, and it took me a little while to adjust to that way of thinking and letting these kids have this free reign. But I thought it was a wonderful experience.
Great. Well, thanks for sharing that experience with us, Lisa. And let's go right back to the phones. And Dennis in Two Rivers is up next. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I don't want to be a worry wart, but just I can imagine there's going to be a time when a child will get hurt. He or she will be crying and screaming, which will distract another child, and that child will end up getting hurt. So, I mean, since there's going to be fewer adults than there are children, are the adults supposed to do triage, figure, okay, well, we have more than one hurt child. Okay, who do we treat first? And ambulances are only going to be able to haul one person at a time.
All right, Dennis, thanks for that counterbalance. And Barbara, what would you anticipate we would need if we wanted to put something like this into practice?
Well, first of all, I think Lisa made a really good point because she brought in this fact of the kids themselves being active, not just in terms of play, but in terms of risk assessment themselves. So that is going to become part of the equation, that the kids get better over time, which is, of course, the whole point, at assessing what's safe to do and what's not. And, of course, what Dennis is worried about is what happens when they make mistakes,
right?
Because the learning process is always going to involve mistakes. But this also goes back to something that Chris said before the break, which is, should we in the United States make playgrounds less safe? And I think that the playground designers in Britain and in Europe might take issue with that phrase, less safe. I think what they're talking about is less sterile. And I'm not suggesting that there would never be an injury, but, you know, the idea of, you know, needing multiple ambulances, I think, is probably not part of the picture, that there's always the risk of some kind of injury when we have children playing vigorously. But that the key would certainly be preparing these children. You know, as Lisa described, this was part of normal cultural patterns where she was teaching at this preschool. And so everybody's doing this together. There's a cultural understanding that this is not something, you know, highly unusual. We are going to approach this in a calm manner. And, yeah, the kids are going to be vigorous, but still they're going to have this kind of training with the whole community in this together. So I really think that the key is just having people who are aware and who are willing to be very vigilant with the kids.
And we have time for maybe one more quick call. Let's go to Alice in Sheboygan. Hi, Alice.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I grew up in a small town, Sparta, Wisconsin, on the west side of the state. My dad had a junkyard and an auto salvage yard, lived on a creek by a railroad trestle, and We had the best time, but also just to say the multi-age. You know, there were brothers and sisters that were 16, 15. Everybody was out. That was wonderful.
Mm.
And I'm bothered where I live that I don't see kids out playing. As we grew up, everybody was out. So you felt that safety. But I never broke anything, fell a lot of times. But it was a great way to grow up on the creek, in the woods. Super.
Thank you so much for that call, Alice. And so, Barbara, you know, what do you think it would take for Americans and American institutions to be comfortable with introducing these opportunities for kids to learn how to assess and deal with risk?
Well, that's a big question. I would really have to think about that. I think the combination of the worries about the medical care and the more sort of litigious culture are very big questions. So what would seem to me more sensible, rather than sort of thinking on a whole United States level, is just to work with certain communities that have shown interest in this by, for example, taking kindergartners out onto forest trails, maybe through Montessori. Or there was an example that I wrote about in my piece of a teacher in Queechy, Vermont, who instituted this under her own initiative in a school in Vermont. And try to work from a local sort of small-scale model and then try to scale up when people begin to see in surrounding communities that it's working well. So I would tend to go for, you know, local parent groups and school boards sort of talking about this and scaling up from there.
And is this a topic that you are going to be continuing to look at and maybe kind of figuring out what ways that could be introduced?
Actually, it isn't. You know, I have written about a column a week for NPR for 6 years, and I just try to take up interesting questions. My work is actually with animal cognition and emotion, so I decided to think of the kids on the playgrounds as little primates like the ones I studied in Kenya and go from there, but it is not a topic that I'll be pursuing, no.
Well, Barbara, thanks for joining us. Really interesting topic.
Thank you very much.
Barbara King is an anthropology professor emerita at the College of William and Mary and a contributor to the NPR blog 13.7, Cosmos and Culture. Her recent entry there was titled, Is It Time to Bring Back Risk to Our Children's Playgrounds? And you can keep the conversation going by tweeting us at Central Time WPR. If you're a parent, would you support this? Why or why not?